Welcome to Haldane's Law Matters. Thank you. Today, I have Ahara Leila in the chair, a famous name from Hong Kong, currently and the past. Mahesh, thank you very much for coming here today. Can I just introduce you this way? It'll probably be inadequate, but bear with me, because I've had the help of AI. We'll touch on AI, probably. We seem to do that every time nowadays in these podcasts. It's omnipresent. You're a permanent Hong Kong-based entrepreneur and a senior member of the Ahara Leila family. You have your own business interests. You're interested in blockchain, healthcare technology, AI, and all sorts of other things, including, of course, hospitality. So welcome to the podcast. And we share one thing immediately in common. We are both ethnic minorities in Hong Kong.
Absolutely.
Okay. And I'm an ethnic minority here since 1978. And I think I'm right in saying you were born here.
Yes, that's correct.
Can we start actually by just giving us a little bit of a sense of being Ahara Leila and the family history for those that don't know it, and for those that do, they'll enjoy hearing it. Just a little sense of the past.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a privilege and an honor as well. The only time I've been to a law office is for other purposes, never for a podcast. So with that, I'm happy to be here. And the family has been in Hong Kong since 1929. Now, that is, I think, quite a remarkable milestone in terms of the changes that Hong Kong has gone through, the transitions from the British colonial powers to more of the people having a voice in Hong Kong, to then the handover to China, and the growth, economic changes, values that we've gone through. So in that context, since 1929, which was really the time of my uncle and grandfather that came to Hong Kong, through the recordings and memoirs that we've been able to access, we really did understand the relevance of our family with Hong Kong's history. To the point today, when you mention ethnic minority, it's somewhat a relegation in terms of what the value of the minority population has actually contributed to Hong Kong's economic output. But we'll touch on that later. Yes, I was born here in Hong Kong. My father, with his three elder brothers, were institutional in setting up a business which traded with the British and the Americans during the time of Vietnam and Korean Wars, that helped us to actually build our business from technically rags to riches to rags, again, to this sustained rich wealthness. Right. We are now 165 family members.
Goodness.
That's huge. We have a house that the family comes together in Kowloon Tong that's been there since 1965, was constructed in 1965, moved in 1969. And that's where the family comes to remain united in its legacy, in its thoughts, and its patterns of behavior.
They could all fit in still?
Not really. 165, we don't have enough bedrooms. And with the moratorium on height restrictions, we can't build up. So it's something else we can touch on. But the key to all of this is legacy. And when we talk about legacy, Hong Kong has a very short history, even though I have friends who are indigenous, 500 years in Hong Kong. The changes that Hong Kong's going through is quite significant in that context. And being able to see those changes, witness those changes, and to live within those changes, and always understand that Hong Kong, for some reason, somehow, is resilient, not by the nature of policies, but by the nature of the people who want to make sure that the city can continue to drive forward. And that, I think, comes to the point of having professionals in here that provide that guiding line. If we didn't have the professionals, if we were just a farmland and we were just focused on a certain aspect of business or growth or opportunity, then we would be confined within a certain space where the world moves and changes. Whereas Hong Kong, we adapt, and the ability to adapt is all about the import of professionals. Now, these professionals, like yourself, Jonathan, an ethnic minority, is an invaluable asset to what Hong Kong actually needs in going forward. We cannot assimilate to be of a certain color or culture. We have to be multicultural. We have to be diverse. We have to be, in a context, a window to the world as we give the world a window into China and vice versa.
I'm just pausing for a moment. That's running against the trend at the moment, because America and other countries are drawn back into themselves.
Yes.
But your view, I actually share this view, is that we should be looking outward and inward at the same time, and we should be as international as we possibly can.
Absolutely. And we have to keep that going and continuing. we can't become another Chinese city, and it's not within the wishes of our leaders in China to say that Hong Kong should be another Chinese city, because frankly, they don't need another Chinese city.
No, they're rich in Chinese cities. You're the third person on Haldane's Law Matters that's actually said definitively, what China wants is us to be different and to be international, to maintain the common law, be useful to them in our difference.
Well, Xi Jinping said this in July 1, 2022. We must maintain common law in Hong Kong. We must maintain that one country, two systems. And that's a critical element that we seem to be missing.
Why don't people listen to that and understand it? Because they don't.
There could be a million reasons which are
derogatory.
No, it's not at all. It's the things that have changed in Hong Kong are quite interesting. We were introduced in the financial world to a return on investment policy or thought or behavior in life. And that return on investment that was actually, I would say, accelerated and curated by American export, which was their biggest number one export, was the venture capital activity. And that started in the 1950s. And it came into Hong Kong when we realized that we actually don't need to build anything when all we need to do is invest into somebody else who's building something. And therefore, our manufacturing has moved out and we've allowed other countries to perform those activities. So what we do is invest. And while we invest, I want to make sure my money and my investments are safe. Therefore, my return on investment window is 3 months. So every action I take, I need to see a result at the end of the quarter. And when you put in your investments for performative activities, you forget the strategic element of what needs to be developed. And that's something that we miss in the way we behave today.
So is this a way of saying that Hong Kong's mode of running its business collectively is that it is too short-term?
I'm not going to say entirely. I'm going to say there are families and there are companies, and we'll touch on that in family offices and structures of a family office.
Yes.
But if we look at the concept of return on investment, it's transactional. It has to be immediate and it has to be a result that qualifies your assessment and your capabilities. And I guess it makes you powerful, makes you rich, and makes you socially acceptable. And therefore, we come to that point, the full circle. Are we so focused on our personal social gains that we forget about the strategic and developmental goals that Hong Kong needs to achieve? And this is what Xi Jinping does. I'm a huge patriot, but I'm an ethnic minority, which I'm not respected as a patriot because of the color of our skin, not my skin. But the collective of the patriotism that Hong Kong is actually, I would say, encapsulated or trying to project is that you must be Chinese. But I'm not Chinese, but I love this city. And I believe in the policies that Xi Jinping has stated, so much so that to a degree, it's bankable. So if you look at his five-year plans, you can say 80% of it is going to succeed. Choose your 80%, structure it, develop it, but your returns are not transactional. It's 5 years down the line.
So it's not any different, of course, from Hong Kong. It's different from the West generally.
Well, this was an analogy that was given to me, a parallel analogy, was that actually Jeffrey Sachs said this, is that Xi Jinping plans way ahead, and he's thinking 25 years down the line. 100 years, a family in Hong Kong, the Lee Kum Kee family, they're thinking 100 years, they're thinking 1,000 years. How do we behave in Hong Kong is that the difference that China sets a policy. India does the same. They set a plan and a policy. The U.S. is winging it. They're reactive. And they're reactive to immediate, I would say, the people, the power of the people to say whether you're acting in the right course or the wrong course. And that comes to a level of education. I think that's something that Hong Kong, China actually values, whereas the U.S. went through a period of saying that education is subjective. And yes, it is subjective if you plan according to a certain way of learning and way of action. And where we have it in Hong Kong and China as well is that education's paramount, but we're also thinking strategic development going forward. And the difference is collaboration. Asian people are collective in society. The Western, I keep saying America. I don't want to offend my American friends, but the individualistic behavior. And I lived in the U.S. for a long period of time. It's always been about me, myself, and I.
Yes.
Right? And it's my personal game, my survival, my battle to see how I can win. Now, what are we winning if money one day has no more value? right? If we're looking for wealth, is wealth only derived by monetary gain? And we have to look at things in a way that, is family part of wealth? Do we look at society as a part of our wealth? If society develops, are we not automatically ingrained with that feeling of joy and happiness that everybody survives and grows? And that allows our economy to actually grow as well. Would that be better? But when we look at it individually, you're not working towards a collective goal. You're working towards myself, and I choose what I want for my personal gain, and I'll go anywhere. So your loyalty and your allegiance to any country or city or township changes because opportunities don't exist anymore.
Yes.
Right? And whereas in Hong Kong, I think we actually do look at things collectively. We look at the enrichment, empowerment of society, which still needs the professionals to come in who are considered transient ethnic minorities and not the color of skin of Western or non-Western, but we are all in that collective global environment of intelligence, creativity for growth and opportunity.
So let me just pause for a moment there. So listening to that, it seems to me that what you're saying is that, if I can talk in political terms, because you carefully phrased it in social terms. But if you look at it politically, what you really have is, let's say, the Chinese and the American models, because it's easy to make the comparison. So my Chinese friends would say the government thinks really about all its people. I mean, that's its raison d'etre, to try and keep society as cohesive and as prosperous and happy as possible. Because that way, the Chinese Communist Party survives, as it has. Yes. The American system has two front runners, one, and they're both battling it out. In recent years, particularly insulting each to the other. One more insulting than the other, but both pretty.
And that's how they win.
And that's how they win. If you don't have to worry about your opponent, you just beat him to the ground.
Yeah.
And that transmits into society itself. The tone set by the President of the United States says something about the rest of the country.
Yeah.
So when Reagan was president, for example, it was a very different tone to the whole of the United States.
Yeah.
Under President Trump, a very different tone from Reagan
and
everywhere else.
Yeah.
Right. So what you're really focusing on are those two political alternatives. And it sounds to me, listening to you, firstly, that I agree.
Yeah.
That's not important, but I thought I'd let you know.
But secondly...
Secondly, that we've probably got, as always, a bit of a mixture of both then, haven't we? We've got some of those Chinese characteristics of longevity and society. I mean, family life is important. Chinese parents, I understand, still expect their children to look after them a bit and so on, where I don't think that's so true in the West anymore. But on the other hand, we're not entirely Chinese thinking. We've got a bit of West thrown in, so there's that immediate profit element as well. Does that sum up what you're saying?
Now, I'm going to share something a little bit deeper, if I
of course.
We have to look at things in, I guess, survival would be one of the main constructs that we have to focus on. Hong Kong went through a very rough time, 2014, 2019. 14 was the beginning of it, and the pieces that came to play emanated in a result of this blow-up of what happened in Hong Kong, 2019.
Yes.
Right after that, we had COVID. And the focus was really about COVID. And it was about taking people and putting them away and safeguarding that element. So you understand the financial impact of that and capacity of hospitals and capability of healthcare. You really do get that. When COVID kind of ended, which still happens today, Hong Kong still providing and mandating the 10th vaccine and making it available for people. And even though the reports come out to say that it's actually not a good thing to have mRNA in your body, in that mindset that the society believes that's safe because we've been advised so that it's safe. So we have to look at the concept of survival in Hong Kong. What does the concept mean? I've gone through this struggle, and I've shared this with a few friends on this point, is that if at the time of the 60s, when Singapore was starting and Lee Kuan Yew came to power and he had his vision and his voice of saying, I need to make this a great nation, and I cannot copy Hong Kong for it to be a trading port, I have to think to be able to leapfrog it. And I look at Hong Kong the last 5 years and I'm saying, we've slowed down and we're looking at different models that work everywhere else and see what fits, and that let's look at regulation another year and a half, 2 years down the line. And I'm saying, maybe we just need to take a step forward. And in taking a step forward, you'll realize whether you've made the right step or the wrong step. But you have to take a step forward in the context that we should not be following a Chinese city. We have to strategically look at Hong Kong's survivability in terms of the one country, two system attribute. This is something Xi Jinping has insisted, Macau, Hong Kong, and demonstrating in the future that there could be an independence, for example, in Taiwan, to take away the fear from the people of Taiwan or the political leaders that are being somehow influenced. How do we ensure that Hong Kong can demonstrate this? We have the tools, we have all the elements that Hong Kong has, which is education, which is professionals and its community that have built wealth, and we've got all the luxuries in the world. But what happened to our creativity? Completely sidelined. So if we focus on the structure, we're never able to adapt to taking a chance on something else. Taking a chance on something else is actually leads to survivability, because you're looking at a step in the future, not an immediate return today.
No, I like it. We'll keep that online, I think.
I think that was a great point.
God has spoken.
So in this, I've come up with a concept on how we can align with China. And it's not my concept. It's people who've been looking at this in the last 5 years or 6 years. And I said, why isn't Hong Kong taking this point of assistive behavior for the future of Hong Kong by looking at the space economy? Now, the U.S. is doing this. SpaceX is doing this. Not the U.S. SpaceX is doing this. And we know there are 100 countries that are now involved in looking at space. And space could be the low Earth orbit or higher beyond and further deep space discoveries. And I'm saying, what's Hong Kong's strength? And I talked with our financial secretary and I asked, if our focus is predicated on our financial capabilities, of which the financial element contributes to 40% of Hong Kong's GDP, why don't we look at elevating that and creating a new bifurcation of activity that would add 3 to 5% growth in our GDP. And let's look at the space economy, because China is powering ahead on this. And it is their policy to ensure that the safety of communication, they just launched 38, similar to Starlink network on 6G, up into space in the last 2 weeks.
So just pausing there for some people that are listening that probably don't know much about the space economy.
Yeah.
So what we're talking about is the development of, for example, satellites, drones, and anything that's up in space rather than on Earth.
This is where the confusion can come in as well.
Yeah.
When we say launching satellites or spaces, Hong Kong is not going to launch a satellite.
Create.
It's not going to have rockets flying out of the ocean or anything that happens, even though our harbors are safe. Nor are we going to be a manufacturing base. But we do have IP capability. Our universities, 6 of them are currently enrolled in space projects. There's a laboratory of space research at HKU. There's HKUST. There is CityU. There's CUHK. All these great universities that we have that are looking at the advanced education aspect, and that's IP.
Yeah. And it's worth mentioning, Manish, because it's always something that's important, that our universities are not just great, they're ranked really highly.
Yeah.
In the world, I think we've got one that's at 11, Hong Kong U, just behind the Ivy League and Oxford and Cambridge.
Incredible, right? Isn't that incredible?
And it's not widely known.
Jonathan, this is a beauty, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Hong Kong's a terrible marketer. We've got to improve our creativity and our marketing.
We should copy the Italians. They're great at marketing pasta and oil. I mean, come on. Let's do education.
Number one international cuisine in the world, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you would think Chinese is,
but
Chinese
important.
Has many different forms.
Yep.
But Italian's pasta,
right?
It's olive oil, and that helped the French and helped everybody else and create their culture.
They're genuinely great at marketing, and we're behind.
I think you're being far too polite. I think we're too fragmented, and we're too focused on certain attributes and not on what is really Hong Kong. Right, we've had people on your show who love the city, talk about food, and they talk about culture, and they talk about just walking the streets and discovery. So let's come back to that after I finish the space story, because
please do.
This is critical, I think, for Hong Kong's future.
I think it's a great story.
It's about finance.
Yeah,
Hong Kong is a financial center. We're the fourth largest foreign exchange in the world, the third largest capital market. Why are we not amplifying that facet of financial activity in Hong Kong. So when we talk with HKX and we talk with Hong Kong SFC, yeah, we want IPOs, we want structure, we want regulation, we want work on it. The insurance companies say, yeah, we got to look at this area because it's interesting. And it's not just about rocket launches. It's not just about satellites. There's many things that's post-launch, which is space mining. It's looking at the moon resource or fuel alternatives. There is biological healthcare that we can actually look at zero gravity to be able to look at crop creation as well as biological development in humans. How do we look at medication that is in a zero gravity or vacuum environment, right? Which is very different. How about before the rocket launches? We look at who makes the rockets. We look at who makes the satellites, look at the technology behind that. And you go all the way downwards to the wiring and the cables and everything else that comes in, the metals, the study of material science that we have here in CUHK, the Chinese U as well, and Polytech. These are phenomenal aspects that can be applied in real-world environments. So let's look at how we can fund it or create the incubation acceleration, work on that concept, and create that financial return. Now, the problem is, if we're looking at short-term gains, none of these will give you an ROI. But in 3 to 5 years' time, that technology will be used almost everywhere, in our daily lives as well. In everything from our mobile phones, our cables, our electrical chargers, everything will use that type of technology. And that's where you get your mass returns.
Mahesh, is the government behind this, or do we rely on private?
I think it has to be both, right? The government has to say, yes, we're ready to look at this. And I'm hoping that in the lobbying by certain parties, myself included, that we've got the government to listen. And I think that's a great, huge step. The other side of it, how do we activate the investment world? So when we look at banks, banks say, hey, look, in Hong Kong, I'm not the world. If we look at banks, we're looking at transactional. Oh, property is great. It's fantastic. I know 10 years and it's private credit, so to speak. And we can look at this and say we're safe from returns. At the end, we arrest the asset. But if the asset values are dropping as they have, how can we ensure that's sustainable going forward? So we have to look at then the family offices and the professionals that support the family offices that are not family-owned businesses, because family-owned business, like for us, it's hotels.
Yeah.
So when I'd say, hey, space, they're going to say, come on, it's hotels. Are we going to build a hotel in space? Yes, we will, but not now, right? Maybe 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, we may do something. But let's look at outside of that and in a family office structure that looks at how we look at welfare for the family, how we look at sustainable investments that actually plant the seeding of investments that create a long-term return rather than the short-term ROIs.
Okay, may I ask? So yeah. I know that you're very influential in the Arulela family office.
Let me rephrase that. I'm the convener of the family council.
All right.
Which we have certain council members, and that's taken us a couple of years to organize and structure.
Yeah.
We haven't come to the investment side of it, but having said that, we're starting to build that ideation that we have to look at the sustainable practices of investment. But and then we need a financial committee who would look at this, and who are those people in the committee that would look at the CIO, so to speak, and build on that.
So you preempted my question, which is, was your family office or was your family business going to be investing in space? And the answer is, it's under review.
First, I hope so.
Yeah.
If you ask me, have I invested in space? I've invested into facets that are to do with space.
Yeah.
I'm a great fan of Star Trek. I mentioned this. And I grew up in that era. One of the things is that when you watch it today, and you look back in 1967 when it was first created, and all the technology that they had, we're actually using it today.
Yeah.
It's come into fruition. Was it predictive? Was it something that they knew that we didn't know? Which is telecommunications, voice commands. Today you can talk to, hey Siri, and you get yourself a prompt. You got AI, artificial intelligence, and the characters of that, the data capability that came in. And then you have now transportation, communication.
Yeah.
Right? Communication, the mobile phones, the cellular phones, right? That running on cellular networks. But what if when we launch satellites into space that Starlink has done, it's no longer ground driven? It's all up in space.
Stuff that's like Starlink, is that the future for communications?
Yes, there is a danger to having a company control it.
Yeah.
Right? There's a danger that if a country controls it, or is it open source, so to speak, that all countries can be able to utilize as long as you pay the links, and can never be used as a sanctionable element, as the U.S. has demonstrated with the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the West has adopted that as the best way to move forward. You can't use financial instruments as a sanctionable activity, which is now, I think it's not so much about our loss because we don't perform in those restricted practices, but it is a loss to the respect that we had for America in being a freedom in the free world and identity of what is right, the values of good and bad and the values of right and wrong. And that's completely erased to your question. Today is Trump, who is very different from Reagan. And I had a great deal of respect for Reagan. I have a great deal of respect for Lee Kuan Yew in the aftermath of what is happening today. This world has gone into a point of, I must win at no matter what cost to whomever. So you have genocide that takes place, you have wars that take place, and the community, the families, the people who are affected by this don't ask for it. I don't want. I'm born in this country. I'm raised here. What if someone just decides to bomb Hong Kong? And we had that very near experience of 2019 in Hong Kong, right? I saw it outside my house. I saw it in Tsim Sha Tsui. I saw it outside the universities and here in Central. I mean, does that not scare you that we could just get into this mayhem and that's so disruptive to our lives and that I didn't want or ask for? And I thought about this. I said, couldn't the solution have been something much more simpler? Could we not have communicated with the distraught or the disenfranchised or these youth who are saying, where's my future? And instead of saying, I can't listen to you, I'm stronger than you, I'm bigger than you, I have the title, therefore you must listen to me. And that's not how you build confidence in your city or your country. You have to be able to listen to your community, to work with your community. This was done in 1960s, 70s in Hong Kong when Sir Murray McLehose created district councillors, right? What happened to our district councillors today?
Mahesh, it's interesting you mentioned Murray McLehose. When you were talking about this, I was actually thinking of him. So there's obviously a telepathic connection. Yeah. And he was probably the best governor, leader of Hong Kong, at communicating to the whole of the population. I mean, he was responsible for public housing, and he was responsible, as you say, for changes in the governance. And I'm not sure we've had anyone quite like him since, have we?
I think the governors we've had post-McLehose were very good at liaising between the UK and the will of the people. Yeah,
they were competent, for sure.
During the time of change in China, where Mao Zedong and then Deng Xiaoping came into power, to understand the changes. And if McLehose didn't make that change, a fundamental change, the power rising in China, the voice of China, the changes, the communist power. And we continued in the same way in Hong Kong of being top-down British ruled, Hong Kong would have died a premature death because it would have been the Brits against the locals.
So in a way, McLehose saved Hong Kong.
Sure, he listened. And he said, if we don't, in his very words, if we don't recognize that the people of Hong Kong have a voice and we don't start making that change, Hong Kong, China will take over, maybe. Or Hong Kong will kill itself. There'll be a civil war. And in making that change was a phenomenal foresight in understanding the future of what Hong Kong needed to be.
Yeah.
Public housing was one of them, right? 70% of the population, the squatter huts and all of that.
Started to be removed.
And that
the ICAC, of course.
Oh, fantastic. Really fantastic.
Yeah. Well, it changed Hong Kong from being riddled with corruption and slowly, over time, sorted it out. It was, in fact, a model for the rest of the world.
I have to come back to this point of saying that we seem to be looking at the past a little bit too much. The structure's been established. Now we're looking at the past. While the world has changed, we're not making the changes that the world needs or the population needs. So we're stuck on a specific model. And the model was valid at that time, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. I'll give you that. Then the last 20 years, things started to shift.
Well, there was obviously a change because it became not British rule, but Chinese rule. So what we've been talking about for the last 5 minutes is actually the past governors, funnily enough.
Yeah.
Mahesh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. We're going to continue this again in a week or two. Thank you.